It's time for what Podcast International called the greatest podcast in history. Open your ears, because it's time for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.
All right, everybody, this is Brian Callen. This is Man Thoughts with Brian Callen, because that's what I decided to call it, Man Thoughts. It's kind of ridiculous. But I have a special guest, and I'm just going to say his name is Matt. I know his last name, but I think he feels more comfortable just giving, you know, one name. And Matt, you have done, I think, 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, together 5.
Five. Just hold the mic closer to your. Yeah, I know you're not. I know you're not used to this. I know
I'm
you're
sorry.
A soldier.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Together 5. Yeah.
Together 5.
I've been out for a little bit, but yeah.
And you were in the Rangers.
I was with 375 Ranger, and I was a ground force commander, so I was in charge of different assault forces while I was over there, independent.
What do you mean by assault forces?
So my unit was my organic unit, which was 30 to 40 individual Rangers, plus a few different other government agencies.
Like special forces teams?
Special forces. So my brother is 5 years older than me. He also went to West Point, and he's in special forces. And a lot of people have a misconception about what special forces Green Berets do.
Okay.
And special forces Green Berets, they are. I mean, it's inevitable that they get into combat operations, but their sole role.
Hold that closer.
Their sole role is to train and advise indigenous forces in whatever country that they're in.
Okay.
Whereas Rangers and other government agencies, our role is to direct action missions, kill capture, hostage rescue type missions.
Okay, you guys are doing the real. You guys are actually getting in there with your guns and doing and carrying out the missions. If you have a high value target, you're either killing him, you're capturing him. I don't know if you can go into this, but. Let's put it this way. There is a decision that's made between whether you capture someone or kill someone. Or is it all dependent upon the situation? You have a high value target. You either capture if you can, kill if you can't.
How yes. Obviously, yeah. That is all based on the individual, to be honest. My Rangers were unbelievable. I could have literally 2 Rangers in every single house that I was taking over before we even decided to wake somebody up in the house. And we would decide, do they have a body bomb on? Do they have some sort of threatening device on their body before we ever even woke anybody up? And that's how good...
These guys were in the house before your high-value targets were even awake.
Yes. So my brother is a Green Beret, and he was at the same base that I was during my second special ops deployment, and he used to come on my compound, and he would literally watch on flat screens while I was on target doing missions, and he would say, "Your soldiers are unbelievable," and I could not agree with him more.
You were embedded. I know that with Ranger units, you guys are often they embed these sort of crack commando teams like Delta Force, like DevGru, otherwise known as SEAL Team 6. And I'm wondering if you probably I would imagine worked with SEAL Team 6. You worked with Delta Force. Is that correct?
So I'll tell you that I was a very young commander, but I have never worked organically with a Ranger unit because I was always chosen to work with other government agencies.
I like how general you are. You worked with other government agencies. Let's just say that they might or might not have been DevGru / SEAL Team 6 or Delta Force, right?
In both Iraq and Afghanistan. And we had, like I said, direct action missions. So we were hitting targets at the same time, and we were trading off with those targets with other groups. And like I said, my brother would literally watch us do those targets. And we would rather capture somebody than ever kill somebody.
Sure.
Not because, I mean, we are humane. The United States government is definitely humane. We would rather do that. But there's a lot of information that I can pull out of somebody on target and possibly follow on to other targets if that person is alive.
Right.
So I would much rather pull somebody off target, whether they're even wearing a body bomb or not, if they're alive, and we're going to pull information out of them and then follow on to other information so that my special operations group can save the lives of conventional soldiers in the entire area.
Can you tell me, and it may not be in your job description, but when you guys do capture a high value target, just a target, and you you want to get information out of them, do you pass them on to an interrogation team, or do you do the interrogating yourselves?
So I have individuals in my group that I'm in charge of that specialize in interrogations. And then I've been given specific training in specializing in that sort of thing. So when we get on target, say there is, I mean, we're in a hotel room right now. There's maybe four rooms in here. It's the same sort of thing. We'll come in there and we will split women and children up. There might be women and children all in this room where we are. And we're going to take one at a time men into other rooms. And The other individuals will take one man at a time, and I will take one man at a time. Me personally, we both have interrogators or I guess interpreters,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk to them individually to try and pull information out of them on target.
So when you're on target, you actually begin the interrogation process.
Yes.
Who is watching out that you guys follow the guidelines the U.S. government sets? As far as you know, I know that you can only waterboard somebody under very very specific circumstances. We have very specific notions on what torture is. You can't get physical with somebody. You can probably use sleep deprivation and things like that. I don't know, but what is from your experience as an interrogator, what is your view on? There was such a raging debate on that what constituted torture and what actually works. What is your view on that, and what is your philosophy on interrogation?
In all honesty, there's nothing inhumane about it. There's no torture. There's no waterboarding. There's no extraneous like circumstances that you're with on target with them. It's just you pull them one at a time out. You ask them simple questions. You can tell through training. I mean, I can place my hand on your heart and ask you questions and tell if your heartbeat quickens or slows and watch your eyelids and all that sort of thing.
And so you watch their body language, and a lot of times they're telling you something that you don't even – yeah, okay.
Yeah, and throughout the day – like I said, I mean, I have multiple flat screens throughout the day. I mean, I'm
breaks from football.
I'm a normal American individual, so where I love college football, but I do watch my targets before I go out there, and I can tell if that individual is telling very simple lies. You know what I mean? Very white
sure.
lies. What does your car look like? Is it blue or is it green? Is it white or is it red?
Mm.
Have you been to the market today? No, you haven't. Have you been to the field today? What have you been doing? How many people are in the house? You know, very, very simple things where you can get a baseline on what is the truth and what is not the truth.
Okay.
So, like, you, I could take in the other room, and I could say, what have you been doing in Vegas today?
I'd be lying, as fast, but, exactly. I'm sure you'd exactly. find out. Because what happens in Vegas
very,
stays
very
in Vegas.
Measures, you can tell if somebody
we're in Las Vegas, by the way, as I conduct this interview, but keep going.
Yeah, so very simple measures, you can tell if somebody is being completely honest with you or not, and that leads you to what actions you take on target with those individuals.
Right.
I mean, I've been on where certain aircraft cannot fly at certain hours, and I've been on one target where I've pulled off literally in one in one town, I've hit five different houses based off information I've pulled off one target.
Wow. Okay.
And come out during the day with only certain aircraft screaming in, dusting off, while we load people.
What does dusting off mean?
So say you've seen in a desert, right? You've seen in a desert, you got the Blackhawks coming in low.
Yeah.
They're kicking up all that dust in the desert. And we're running on it with multiple people that we think are not people that are friendly with the U.S. government.
You take them off to somewhere else to actually get more information out of them.
Yeah, and we will put them on the aircraft, but very, very low profile, because if we fly certain aircraft during the day,
it's
a large target that they can shoot weapons at.
Can you tell me what the difference between Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 is?
I mean, one's Army, one's Navy.
That's it. But they're pretty much the top rung of the military, as far as they're just the elite of the elite physically, generally, right? I was in Afghanistan, and I met one of the guys. They didn't really tell me he was Delta, but it was interesting. He was such a physical specimen. I mean, you're obviously in very good shape.
I will tell you that I can hold my own.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure. And I want to get to the training that it takes, like what the distinction. I've heard legendary stories from Green Berets, actually, about what it takes to be a Ranger. You know, just the training, the sleep deprivation.
Like I said, the Green Berets, my brother's a Green Beret. My brother is 5 years older than me, went to West Point, same as I did. Absolutely my idol in every single way. He is the mentally toughest person I've ever met in my life.
Wow.
But when it comes to our mission set, he does not hold a candle to what we do, and that's why I used to get him on to watch what we do.
Do you consider yourself a Ranger, or do you consider yourself somebody from another government agency?
I'll say Ranger first, just because all my soldiers, they are 100%, whether they are privates and they're 18 years old, or whether they are privates, like I've told you while we were sitting here talking, who were ex-investment bankers. They are the smartest individuals I've ever met in my life, and literally some of those guys have saved my life on situations, and they are unbelievable.
Delta recruits from the Green Berets. They recruit from Rangers. They recruit from the Marines. I mean, is that true, like the Force One Recon and all those guys?
Yeah, so the reason why I love those guys...
Those guys. That might or might not be Delta. Keep going.
I like a lot of those guys because... So, in the Rangers, we have privates in our unit.
Mm.
You yourself could go into a recruiting station and say, I want to be a Ranger. They will send you to basic training. They'll send you to AIT. They'll send you to airborne school. And then they'll send you to Ranger school.
Okay.
If you get through all those things, you can come hang out with me.
Hey, you can be a Ranger.
Yeah. But the other individuals... you have to be a certain rank before you come hang out with them.
Meaning you have to have a minimum amount of experience in a unit like the Rangers before you are invited to try out for Delta.
To those units, yes. And a lot of my soldiers, a lot of the guys that I was with, are the people that feed those units. So they were started because of the Rangers, because of exceptional soldiers that I used to deal with. And so they feed that, and there's a very much a kind of a big brother system.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense.
So while we were over there, and I was chosen to work separate from any Ranger unit with other units, because of the things that I specifically was doing, they were acting as big brothers to my soldiers, to me, myself. And when we exceeded, they definitely took notice of that.
You are obviously somebody who distinguished himself as a soldier. But what do you think, what is your background? And your brother, obviously, where did you guys grow up? What was your sports? What were the sports you did?
So, I mean, we grew up in Indiana and Purdue University. We played football, baseball, basketball, you know, all those.
All American kids, man.
I mean,
team players.
Random everyday stuff. Coming out of high school, I was recruited by multiple colleges for baseball and everything. My grandmother, we were big Purdue fans. My grandmother literally told me, I will never speak to you again if you go to Notre Dame to play baseball.
Wow.
You know, that sort of thing. So West Point said, hey, we'll take you to play baseball. When I got there, I actually decided to play football. And then, you know, like random sports while I was there. And then when I graduated.
Your life was very physical when you were in the military?
It was, yeah. But I think that's a good thing. And not only for the physical aspect of it, but I think that there are very many physical things that translate to mental aspects that make the military worthwhile. So when I was conventional and even when I was with my Ranger unit, is that everything I did had some aspect of competition to it. Because I didn't want somebody that could hide out in the crowd and be good, but hide. I wanted somebody that either had to exceed or failed making somebody else try to exceed, if that makes that makes sense.
You were looking for team players, guys.
Not necessarily
who,
team players, but leaders.
Leaders. I would imagine that it, what is required in a unit that is perhaps an elite unit, let's call it, whether it's, you know, the groups I mentioned, I would imagine that you need a certain amount of lateral thinking, a certain amount of out-of-the-box thinking. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's definitely fair to say. Yeah. Like I said, my squad leaders, my leaders were exceptional individuals. I would watch certain individuals during the day, and I would decide I would like to go after this individual because of the circumstance, because of the environment he was in, because of the time of the day, whatever the environment around him was. And I would ask my squad leaders, tell me what you can do with this situation. And they would come back to me with, I mean, absolutely amazing, amazing things.
Well, let me shift the focus here a little bit, because you are obviously, you know, you speak so highly of your unit. And one of the things that my limited experience around soldiers, it was just in Afghanistan and stuff. What I loved about my experience in Afghanistan was there are a lot of things I loved about it. But when you're in the military, it's all about the guy, the other people. It's never about yourself. You come last. It's always about your unit. It's about your country. It's about the ideology. And it's about the guys in your team. It's whether or not he's a Ranger or whether he's a Marine. It is an environment that requires teamwork. It requires you to put yourself last and others first. And I think personally, from what I saw, it brings out the best in people. I don't live in a world like that. I live in Hollywood where it's all about me. It's all right. It's all about me. And I always am. I find that so refreshing when I'm around soldiers. They just tend to be. You guys really do live this sort of idea of, because it's a life and death situation, a lot of times you have to rely on each other. If you don't rely on each other, if you don't have each other's back, then it can mean catastrophe. You know, I was just with Shane Carwin and Brendan Schaub, who are two big time MMA guys, and Nate Marquardt, who's my buddy and who you'll meet tonight. And you know, they were saying, yeah, what we do is amazing, but what you know, the military is what I think is so amazing, because those guys really are living life and death. You know, whenever we say, well, you know, you go to war when you get in that octagon, you get in that cage, you know, they do. But at the same time, there is a difference. You know, when you're in Afghanistan, the fact is you see death all the time. This is a long roundabout question, but I'm just kind of shifting here. I want to know, as somebody who spent five tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, how have you changed? How have you changed? And I'll be specific about what I mean by that. How have you changed from when you started to when you finished, vis-a-vis your idea of American foreign policy, what we're doing there, and things like that? I don't want to put you on the spot, because obviously you have friends that are still there.
That's fine.
But how have you changed?
So you guys have probably seen that latest movie with the Navy SEALs. I don't know what it's called.
Uncommon Valor or something like that.
Act of Valor.
I did not see it.
So there's obviously some Hollywood action going on. It's real life Navy SEALs, SEAL Team 6 guys doing real life targets, that sort of thing. And I've seen it. And obviously there's some Hollywood effects going on with the gunfighting. But the concepts are very, very true, in that when I've been over there, I've never once thought, well, I've flown on a helicopter, I'm about to do this direct action mission, and I might die on this mission, and I'm doing this for my country. I've thought about it, whereas I've had people next to me, and I've thought, if this guy has something happen to him, there is nothing I wouldn't do for that individual. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense.
So
you've always held on to that. That hasn't changed.
And it's not that we have a lack of patriotism or we have a lack of, desensitization from the United States. It's that you do things for the person that's next to you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well, because we have a civilian government and because the military carries out what the civilian government says, you know, you guys are a lot of times taught to carry out orders, carry out the mission, and to carry out the mission, you've got to be somewhat idealistic. You can't be thinking about, well, this may not be good in the long term and things like that.
You don't think about the greater picture on that. You think of, I am here in the now, this is my mission, and if this X individual gives the go-ahead for that mission,
you're going to do it.
This is what's going to happen. And because, like I said, if I, as a Special Operations Ground Force Commander in charge of 60 people, can affect an entire region, like, say, an entire state of Nevada, because of this one action, if I can take out this financial individual that is feeding money into insurgent operations in Nevada, and I can take him out, then I will not only save my soldiers' lives.
You'll save other lives.
But I'll possibly save conventional soldiers' lives, which I was once a conventional soldier, which I was, you know, my brother who's Special Operations driving out there every day.
Sure.
And if I can prevent him from getting blown up by a
IED. Yeah.
Because I didn't drive anywhere.
Yeah.
As a Special Operations soldier, I flew everywhere. That's the luxury of it.
That's way better.
That's a luxury.
Sure.
But my brother drove everywhere every day.
That's terrifying.
Every day.
Because I drove everywhere for 11 days, and I was literally waiting to get blown up. And we'd drive so fast, it was terrifying.
And that's the way I was conventionally. My first deployment, we drove into an area that we were literally hitting 3 IEDs a week in my area. I took over the area as a 22-year-old kid, no joke, kid.
Yeah.
And within 2 months, we broke it down to 1 IED every 2 months, and we had surrounded the entire town during the Saddam trials on the Tigris River with an all Saddam supportive town.
Wow.
And we completely
shut that down.
Shut it down.
Wow.
Because I told my soldiers, you will not be afraid to walk out of any building in this place. You will know every street. You will know every backwoods. You will know everything. And you will be the aggressor. You will not be the antagonist, but you will be the aggressor.
You'll meet
that situation.
Right.
And we would literally walk into every street in the town. And by the time I left in 5 months, my soldiers could walk into a shop and get an ice cream cone before they left and not have a worry about getting shot.
That's pretty amazing. But having been so directly involved on such a myopic level, having been sort of literally having your hands in the dirt, so to speak, now that you've pulled back, now that you're looking at the big picture, do you have any thoughts that you didn't have before? Do you have a point of view that's maybe different than you did 5 years ago? On the Iraq war, on the Afghanistan war, on future wars the United States might get into.
And honestly, it makes me want to unhandcuff them even more.
The military?
Yes. While we're over there, obviously because of political reasons, because of the hearts and minds reasons and all that sort of thing, we had restrictions on us. You know what I mean? And a lot of times there is good reason for it, but a lot of times there's probably a reason why we shouldn't have it on us.
Okay.
You know, and I think that if you're going to fight a war, you have to
fight a war. Yeah. I've heard other military guys say that. I've heard other military guys say if you're going to go to war, then the war is the business ultimately of killing people or making our country safe, which sometimes requires violence that maybe a civilian government wouldn't be comfortable with or maybe wouldn't be so popular. But the bottom line is that is the business of war if you want to get down to it. And if you're going to get a group of people who are expert at that, you've got to let them do their job. If you handcuff them, because I happen to know that a lot of our SEAL Team 6, a lot of our special ops guys, for a long time, you know, before 9/11, were not allowed to do a lot of stuff. I mean, that's they were handcuffed. Talk about handcuffed. We were not. I mean, most of those guys were on a base just doing missions. They were not allowed to really go out there and do their missions. So you had a bunch of highly trained commandos, and there were probably a lot of circumstances in hindsight, and I have to be fair in hindsight, but a lot of circumstances where we probably could have taken out a certain terrorist cell before they did what they did.
Yeah.
Because we had intelligence, but we did, but for political reasons, we didn't want to use our commando teams.
Yeah,
you know?
So like you're saying, I mean, exactly to your point, my wife would probably kill me for this, but the only thing I miss about the military is my deployments.
Well, that's what I was going to ask next. I mean, you know, you did some very dangerous work, it sounds like, and you were always in harm's way. And I would imagine that you can get addicted to that fear and that adrenaline.
It's not even the fear and the adrenaline. It's that
feeling needed, feeling...
No. I mean, you played high school sports, right?
Yeah.
So imagine you went to practice every day and you'd not ever get to play a game.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, it's very much so.
So
very much so.
Just like the military, and just like any other organization in the world, you go to practice every day, and you do your best, and you take care of your soldiers, you take care of your people, and you want to see how you stack up against the competition.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. I don't know if it makes sense to a lot of women, but certainly for men.
So you go over there and you're stacked up against the competition. You're stacked up against the competition. And like I said, 5 deployments, my soldiers way more than my talent ever could be. The proudest thing I will ever say in my life is that I never lost a single soldier while I was over there in 5 deployments.
And that's amazing. That's actually incredible.
And we killed or captured as much or more as any other special operations unit during that time while I was there. My unit was chosen to be independent of my organic parent organization, and we stacked up against the best of them. And that's how amazing my soldiers were.
Hmm. Now, how do you, as a commander in a unit like that, there's a lot of weight on your shoulders in that you've got to kind of set the agenda, right? I mean, the agenda is set by probably higher ups as well. However, when you're sort of a, for lack of a better word, a field general in that circumstance, where you have direct contact with the enemy and direct contact with the indigenous population,
yeah,
you've got to make a lot of those calls on your own.
Yeah, and I think that the best thing to do, and what I love about interacting with individuals like you and other people, is that you just have to be a normal guy.
Yeah.
In all honesty.
Yeah.
If you walk into a unit and you act holier than thou,
yeah,
and those soldiers will not listen to you, because if you act, I am better than you.
Sure.
Those soldiers will say, screw you.
Well, you know, you speak like almost every soldier I've met who's been in a position of a commanding position, in that you're always praising your team.
They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I hear that a lot. That can be actually a problem sometimes in the military, because what happens is generals, when they get around each other, they're very, very respectful of each other. But then what happens is there becomes a culture of there becomes a protocol that is so strongly embedded that it's very difficult for one general to say to the other general, you know, this may not be the best policy. So things kind of move a little bit slowly.
Can I tell you two stories?
Yeah.
Two stories. So one is, like I said, I will completely respect my squad leaders, my platoon sergeant, everybody that has been there more times than I have. But the ultimate decision comes on my shoulders. So I have been on situations where we're walking through a town, it's the middle of the night, and we're walking through an area that we were literally in the week before. So there's a possibility that those people saw us a week before and laid a bomb for us or something like that. And I told my team leader, who's possibly a 23-year-old kid, I'm 26 maybe year old at the time, and he's going to walk us through the same area. And I said, don't do that. And his whole thing is, I know this area. I'm going to walk us through the same thing because it's easier for me.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we go through.
So you have a discussion.
Yeah. So we go. But the thing is that you cannot have a discussion when you're on target.
Okay.
So I'm a very much a democracy type of person. When I am back and I am planning for a mission, every single one of my squad leaders, every single one of my team leaders, my platoon sergeant, everybody, I don't care if you're a lowly private, I don't care what you are, you can say, hey, this is what I think about it, and I will listen to you. Because, But when we are on target, when it is time to hit that house, when I have...
It ain't a democracy. It's a command structure.
When I have literally millions of dollars in the air watching me, and I will say...
I never thought of that, but you do. You have millions of dollars in the air watching you. Fuel,
I'll tell you some everything else. Crazy stuff on target just off of in the air, and what I'll have them look at while I do on the ground. While I'm in the air, and what their fuel allotment will let them see while I'm on the ground. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
There's a whole timing piece. It's a it's a Tetris puzzle that you have to put together on the ground, and that's what I run. I control the chaos, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And
so every mission is costing a lot of money.
Millions of dollars. And if one of my soldiers, because they don't feel like walking an extra half a mile.
Yeah.
If they don't feel like walking an extra half mile, they can literally control $500,000. But if I don't agree with that because I control the chaos, then I have a very big problem with that.
That's amazing. That's a huge responsibility.
And
I mean, your decisions, you're making multi-million dollar decisions all the fucking time.
On split seconds. And when we get back to it, I don't yell. You can probably tell I'm a very calm individual.
Yeah.
I do not get mad. I don't.
You seem like a good guy too. Just
I don't get mad.
Guy,
I don't get yell. I don't yell. I don't do that sort of thing. But I have sat my soldiers down before and I've said, democracy, like I told you. You can tell me anything you want. I'm not going to second guess you. You've done it 100 more times than me. But when we are on target and I tell you to do X, you will do X and you will not recommend Y.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Yep.
And it's not because I know more than them.
It just has to be the way it is because second guessing and split second time gets people killed.
Because say I take the recommendation on Y, we hit the target at 1 o'clock in the morning and the individuals run out of fuel at 12:30, they have to go refuel and we try and hit this target, all of a sudden we're getting shot at and we don't have aerial support until 1:15. So we have 15 minutes of getting blasted with machine gun fire without aerial supervision because my soldier decided to walk around that block.
Wow.
I mean, is that does that make sense?
That's crazy is what it means. Yeah, it sounds crazy.
It's a very...
These are little things that as a civilian you never really think about.
It's a very specific timing issue.
Yeah, it's a very specific timing
issue. And I've had, I'll tell you this, in my company, this individual, I'm not going to take credit for it, this individual was in my company, not in my platoon, my very first special operations deployment. I'll say his name, Mankati. Awesome individual. He was climbing on a ladder into a building. An individual poked a pistol out of the room and shot Mankati in the face. It went through his night vision glasses. He fell on the ground. Before he ever uttered a word of help, he threw a grenade through a window, returned fire, directed his five team members what they were supposed to do, then came on the radio and said, hey, I need help. I just got shot in the head. We all thought he said, I got shot in the hand.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Well, that's where you're...
And he still finished the mission. He got shot in the face.
That's so incredible. But that's where you're training. That's why you guys train repetitively so that everything is an instinct.
But
right?
That's why I praise so highly those individuals because they're absolutely incredible to me.
Mankati, you're a stud. That's why your name is Mankati.
Exactly.
Now, how is he doing right now?
He's actually good. He's leading. He's leading soldiers in Range Battalion.
So he didn't lose sight in his eye,
So another guy I got to give a shout out to is Kapuscheski.
Kapicheski.
He is quite possibly, everybody can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but he is the very first soldier to ever do a jump. So jumping out of an airplane as a paraplegic, he jumped out with one leg, lost a leg while we were in Iraq, and he was leading soldiers with my unit.
With one fake leg?
With one leg. And
I didn't even know you were allowed to do that. I thought you got kicked out. You had to retire.
He is the very first soldier to lead combat troops.
Stud.
With one leg.
What a stud.
Joseph Kapicheski, unbelievable.
Joseph Kapicheski, you're a stud. And you can come on this podcast anytime.
Honestly, will kick my ass in anything I do, and he has one leg.
And what is he, a Ranger?
Yes, he is a 375 Ranger.
Unbelievable. Why do you say 375 Ranger? What's that mean?
I mean, there's multiple Ranger battalions.
Okay.
You got some in out in Washington. You have a few different ones in Georgia. But my unit, we're 3rd Battalion, Ranger Battalion in Georgia.
So you miss the military. You miss being in the military a little bit, huh?
Yeah, like I said, I miss my deployments. I miss being around those guys. Yeah, yeah. Something I miss.
And we're winding down in Afghanistan and Iraq. You hear a lot of things in the news, and you hear a lot of people say that Afghanistan, or especially Iraq, was a mistake. Do you ever get yourself involved in those kinds of discussions, or is it just a no-win situation?
I mean, it's honestly not our choice to make. You know?
There you go.
I mean, it's for those soldiers to act on.
Okay.
And to do their job. It's not my decision to decide should we be there or not.
Sure.
You know, if they say to be there, if we have to do this mission, if we're going to take this bad guy off the street, so
that's your job.
These five soldiers can live, then that's their job.
That's your job.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, brother. Well, listen, man, I appreciate you being on the podcast, and this is great.
Hope I filled you in a little bit of stuff. And
very much. Very much. You coming to the show tonight?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, then I will do my best to make you laugh, brother, because you did your best to keep us safe, and we appreciate
it.
And it's always kind of an honor to talk to people who put themselves at risk and did the best they could to ensure that we're safe. Because, you know, I never really voice any political point of view other than the fact that I'm a libertarian and I just believe in maximum personal liberty. But that's as far as I go with my philosophy. But one of the things that I'm from New York, and my buddy lost his brother in 9/11. I remember very, very clearly and very well when those planes hit. And we can go into intellectual reasons about why these things happen, and historians and political scientists will forever debate the origins, the wisdom of going into Afghanistan and Iraq and things like that. But I will say that we owe, as a democracy in this country, a great deal to soldiers and their effort and their bravery. There are wars that maybe are more just than others. Again, I don't get involved in that discussion, but I do think that respect has to be paid to people like you who the people that came before you and the people that will come after you, who chose to make the sacrifices that you make. Because there are a lot of people who I went through those hospitals, and there are a lot of people there that you know, paid with their limbs, with their sight, with their hearing, and with their lives. And we owe a great deal of gratitude to the veteran in this country, I think. And you can go all the way back to World War I, but really especially World War II. You know, so much of what people like me, and I get to be a stand-up comic, and I get to walk around and know that I'm represented by a government, and know that, you know, I'm pretty safe from some maniac who wants to blow me to bits. That is a luxury that a lot of people forget. They forget the effort that went into creating that luxury for us. And so, you know, I think that it's very, very important to always keep that in mind. And so that's my little diatribe. That's my little piece on why I appreciate the military. And my father was a Marine. So, you know,
yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And like I said, my soldiers were amazing, and it doesn't matter should we be there or should we not be there. The fact is that, I mean, they are there. You know what I mean? And I'm in Las Vegas right now. I'm gambling. I'm having a great time. I'm partying it up, and I don't have to worry about is something.
What do you want to do next? What's your next thing?
I like what I'm doing right now with banking.
Oh, okay.
Court's cousin hooked me up, and
good.
We got a good thing going on. Brad and the group have been good to me and everything. But, you know, I mean, my soldiers, I still take measure of them. They still message me all the time.
Well, I'm sure you make very, very deep and lasting friendships when you're in a foxhole like that.
Yeah, I mean, you do. And I hope that as an officer, you switch out quite a bit, unfortunately, because you have to switch in different units and you have different commands and all that sort of thing. But I hope that while I was there, you know, I made some sort of lasting impression on them as much as they made an impression on me. You know,
it's very interesting to hear you talk. I know I was about to wrap this up, but it's very interesting to hear you talk because you always talk about this effort that you went through in terms of your effect on other people. Not your effect on so much even the war, and you don't get involved in that. But it's pretty cool to hear that. You know, you're a real team player, a team leader. You can see why.
I mean, you hope that you have an effect on them, and not only, I mean, everybody that's going to be in the military has some sort of patriotism to them. But like I said,
how do you deal with PTS? How do you deal with post-traumatic syndrome? How do you deal with guys who've seen a lot of stuff and start to crack, or guys who are having a really hard time with
it? In all honesty, so say I went into battalion, to regiment, I had to be selected from my packet, so I had to apply, I had to be selected, I had to go to a tryout, I had to be evaluated on my interaction with others, my physical ability, my written ability, and then with a psychiatrist.
So by the time you're in those units, you're pretty psychologically sound.
They make sure that you're crazy enough, but not too crazy. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So my soldiers, they were like I said, it wasn't a matter of can you shoot X individual, or are you going to be sad about shooting X individual. It was how fast can you do this, how accurate can you do this, and all that sort of thing. So with my conventional deployment, you definitely had to worry about PTSD. We had soldiers that committed suicide, like random things like that. But with my other units, it just wasn't something that you worried about.
Do you look at life and death differently now that you've been in the military?
I mean, I definitely think about, you know, every day as not necessarily as its last, but you think about, like, what do you have to worry about, you know?
Because you've been intimately connected to, you've seen death, you've probably been exposed to life and death situations and real life and death more than the average person like myself.
So, I mean, yes and no, but you got to think about is that I've been in some crazy situations, and I've never laughed harder in those situations.
I've heard that. I've heard in a lot of dangerous situations, guys are telling jokes.
Yeah, you're crazy. I've rolled off an aircraft before, been blasted at by a machine gun. One of my soldiers tripped coming off. I thought he got shot, and I lifted his 5'7" leprechaun ass off the ground, and he's yelling at me, "I'm fine," and he's laughing his head off.
Oh,
you know?
Jesus.
And we just roll with it, and that's fine. You know what I mean? And it's not, like I said, it's not what you're doing that's the problem when you're over there. It's when you come home, it's what you're not doing.
What you're not doing.
So those situations, yeah, they get crazy, but there's nothing you wouldn't trade for that experience. It's why people, can I make this assumption, is that it's why people come to Vegas, right?
Yeah.
You don't come here to say that you are one of the 1,000 people that went to a club in Vegas. You went here because you're the 10 people that said, "I didn't see a DJ. I took shots with the DJ."
Well, that I was going to say, it makes sense because I always say that adventure and excitement are always in short supply.
Always.
Most people are living, like I do this joke where I say, if somebody turned your life into a movie, do you think you would go and see it? And if you're a guy in your position in Afghanistan, I'm sure you had a lot of situations where that would have made a pretty damn exciting movie, you know. And then when you come into civilian life, a lot of times it's hard to kind of your movie changes. The movie you're living in changes. And you know, that's why people do come to Vegas. That's why people skydive. That's why people do what they do. That's probably why people, you know, find somebody that they like that's sexy or whatever, because it creates adventure.
And we don't have a monopoly on that stuff. That's why everybody does that stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's just the way life is. And as individuals, I encourage everybody to experience life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying you have to sign up as a soldier. I'm not saying you have to go to war. But when somebody says, hey, do you want to go abroad, go see the Philippines? Should you go? Absolutely.
Right.
Why wouldn't you? You know
right.
what I mean? So when I've been on missions, and honestly, I know you, unfortunately, because I'm a Ranger, I know you like SEAL Team 6.
Come on, man. I like them all.
I know. We have a healthy professional rivalry going on. But I've been on missions with SEAL Team 6 where I've landed on the ground while I've been getting shot at by machine guns. And we maneuver with them, and they get their dog shot because we have dogs on target, and I'm helping SEAL Team 6 evacuate their dog and putting my soldiers in harm's way to get a dog, like, flown out of the target. You know what I mean? It's all about experiencing life.
Yeah.
And if something happened to me, would I ever say, should I have been there? Should I have been home with my family, all that sort of stuff? Absolutely not.
Right.
Because I could be there and I could be influencing what happened to my soldiers, and
the risk was worth it.
Yeah, I may not be the best person to be there, but if I can influence them in any sort of way, then I want to be there influencing it, because
you know, whenever you're in those situations, you're right. Certain debates aren't even worth having. It's just you're there. You, this is how it is, and you make the best of it. But I, for one, I'm glad that you were out there, man.
Yeah,
because it sounds like you made a difference. You ready to have some beers and go? And I'll make.
Yeah.
Can I make you laugh now?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go.
Let's go rock and roll. All right, guys, that was Matt. I won't say his last name, but he was you. What was your rank again?
I was a captain.
Yeah, that's Captain Matt, ladies and gentlemen. I'm calling him Captain Matt from now on. And we're gonna go grab some beers and I'm gonna try to get more information out of him. I know he was real general, but this is Man Thoughts.
I'm sorry, I was general.
No, this is Man Thoughts, man. And I like just getting real men on my podcast and talking it out. Oh, by the way, I will be at the Brea Improv September 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, and then I'll be at the House of Comedy in Minneapolis September 19th, 2021. No, actually, I think 18th, September 18th, 19th, 20th, 21. So I hope to see you guys out there. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. God bless. And God bless America.
You've been listening to Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.